Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we unpack the week's big political stories. I'm Mike Siluma. We'll start our chat this week by shining the spotlight on one of the most important institutions of our democracy, the Independent Electoral Commission. That is because the commission has been subject of controversy because of its handling of preparations for the forthcoming municipal elections. Also in this episode of Politics Weekly, we will try to understand the implications of the medical parole given to the former president, Jacob Zuma, which frees him from jail to serve the rest of his term at home. Let's welcome now our guest this week, Ibrahim Fakir, who's an electoral analyst based at the OL Socioeconomic Research Institute, as well as Bongabong Shoba, who is the Sunday Times politics editor.
Man, this aircon is racist.
I've never, ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot?
The problem is that pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a ship.
At arms, can you please come
on the
in?
Point of order.
Let's start with you, Shoba. What's the temperature inside the ANC after what seemed like the makings of the worst electoral disaster for the party?
Thank you, Bramak, for having me once again in your show. Yeah. It is the one of the worst disasters to have hit the ANC. There have been instances where parties have failed to register their candidate, but it has not been at this extent. So there's a lot of finger pointing within the ANC, Mike, about what went wrong. We had the acting secretary general or the deputy secretary general of the ANC. Giving a brief description of what they think might have happened. She was talking about people changing names over and over again and which might have delayed the process. But this is what we know, Bramike, because the list selection process within the ANC is very much contested because it's one of the tools that regional or local leaders use to actually spread patronage, and they want to make sure every time that their people are selected for this position. So that's why it's such a hot issue within the ANC. So that's what the ANC was trying to prevent when it came up with this process of trying to centralize the list selection process. But it seemed as if it backfired because there were instances, as we know now, where there were influential leaders who tried to influence it. There were instances where people chopped and changed names. There were instances where people gave wrong ID numbers, and for what reason, one will never know. So yeah, it's an issue that has caused a lot of contestation within the ANC and ignited the heated debate also within the NEC as well, as we know.
Do you think that this may have implications for Cyril Ramaphosa as president, or maybe or not?
Yeah, it depends in which side you're coming from. His opponents are already saying this has never happened during President Jacob Zuma's time. But as we know, the president has nothing to do with registering candidates. That is the work that is left to the administrative people, such as your regional secretaries or provincial secretaries and the office of the secretary general. But it happens under his watch. So he can't escape accountability there. But so you can expect people to say it happened under him and he must take the blame. But as we know it, as the president of the country or president of the ANC is very much removed from that process, except for instances when they are briefed as the national office bearers of the ANC about what is happening, what are the problems, what are the challenges. Then maybe it's what leadership he gives when those challenges are brought before him.
Mm. In fact, they cryptically, because this has now turned at another level to be so technical that, you know, the average citizen might get confused as to what the whole argument is about, because they on the face of it, this is just a simple matter of having candidates on a ballot form and the citizens going and voting. It seems very straightforward. Now, cryptically, what would you say is the nature of the dispute between the IEC and opposition parties like the DA, because now they're wanting to take up to challenge the decision of the IEC in terms of reopening the nomination of candidates.
The IEC would have been in a bit of a pickle irrespective of what kind of decision they made. So they decided to reopen the process of registration for voters, and along with it decided that they should open for registration and nomination of candidates, which was incidentally closed in terms of the previous timetable. Now, all of this would have been water under the bridge had the Constitutional Court agreed and assented to the idea that there ought to be a postponement for the election. As it turned out, it hasn't, so it opens up this whole debate. Now, both interpretations of what the court said does have some reasonable resonance. I mean, the one argument suggests that if you open up for voter registration, then, and because the court has said that the initial proclamation of the election is set aside, a new proclamation means that the entire process is reopened, and therefore it should follow that the candidate nomination process is also reopened. The flip side of that argument is that the court order is very specific. It says you can contemplate opening up for registration if necessary. So they left even the registration of voters within the discretion of the IEC. The IEC decided, well, to give voters an opportunity, fine, let's open for registration week. They didn't have to necessarily open for candidate nomination, but if they didn't, I suspect the ANC would have taken them to court. Now that they have, the DA is taking them to court. Now, when the court order was released, and there's no judgment, so it's hard to determine what the rationality and the reasoning of the Constitutional Court was, because if we could infer or we could deduct from what its reasoning is, what it is trying to say about the voter registration and, more importantly, about candidate nomination, right? But because we don't have that reasoning, we don't know, so we speculate. And I think it was a bit of an administrative and will be a bit of an administrative nightmare for the IEC. And let's see what the court is now going to say with the DA's challenge. But the nature of the dispute is about whether you open for candidate nomination or not. And the initial inability of the ANC to contain its own internal fractions about how it determines who's on the candidate list or not is not the rest of the society's problems. It's not the problem of the other parties. It's not a problem of the IEC. It's the ANC's problem. Every other party was subject to the same timelines.
Now, you are saying, Pipran, that this is the ANC's problem, it's and no one else's. And another person might say, perhaps we would not even gotten to this stage if it had not been for the complications brought about by the COVID pandemic, because initially that's where the whole consideration started, whether the elections should go ahead or not, etc. Would that be a valid reading of the thing to say, yes, there were complications in the ANC itself and failures, but also the other layer is that we're trying to hold an election under conditions of a pandemic?
But the conditions of the pandemic don't affect the ANC only. It affects everyone in society, including other political parties. And more importantly, forget the parties, it affects voters, more importantly. Now, you could make the argument, Mike, that, look, maybe the IEC was late in approaching the court, but also late in appointing former Deputy Chief Justice Moseneke's commission of inquiry about whether they should have a free and fair election. So you can perhaps quibble about that. But my reading is that, look, even the IEC didn't know anything about whether there would be a reasonable rollout of vaccine. I mean, until a month ago, we didn't know whether anyone over 18 would be able to get a vaccine. We thought it would be limited to people who were 30 to 40 to 50 and older. So at the time at which the IEC realized that the credible vaccine rollout is not going to happen, it was pretty late in the day. It's not their fault. Ideally, Parliament ought to have paid and turned its mind to this. But Parliament fractures as it is, with the parties being completely distracted and preoccupied with their own internal issues rather than issues of state and issues of the public. They didn't pay any mind to this. And so the blame squarely partly may be lying at the IEC, but squarely should lie to Parliament and the parties in Parliament. And then they could have taken a resolution, had a debate, approached the minister and the minister, and then together go and approach the IEC, and then all together as a collective go and approach the court. Second, I think the IEC also, and this is perhaps their mistake, chose the wrong argument in court, because I don't think they premised their argument on saying the impossibility of holding an election. I think the argument was not about the impossibility, because clearly Zambia had one, the US had one last year, many other countries, Uganda had one, had elections over the period of the pandemic. So the argument is not whether you can have free and fair elections. You can, but it comes at a considerable cost, and that cost is potential likelihood of spread, potential new variants, overwhelming the health system. So there's all those issues, and I think they ought to have chose the argument of necessity to say it's not impossible, but we think it's necessary in order to preserve life, to preserve the health system, and not to overwhelm it, and so on. So that would be my take.
Flowing out of the controversy, there is the issue of the reputation of the IEC, which some politicians seem to, you know, to be wanting to put into question. For example, the DA's federal chair, Helen Zille, implied that the IEC was trying to act with inside information of the Constitutional Court and in favor of the ANC. When you look at the reputation of the IEC right now, how much damage do you think this whole controversy has caused to it?
But like, as Ibrahim said, that either way, the IEC was going to be challenged, even if they had decided not to reopen the candidate list, the registration, the ANC would have taken legal action. But What I find interesting, Ramaik, is the explanation from the IEC as into how they reached this point. It's very much unconvincing to me as a layman. I'm not a legal person, and when they talk about why they chose to open the whole process and maybe not allow for those people who are going to change their details, people who are affected or who are going to be moving from one ward to another or one municipality to another, allow those people then to be able to register. And the reasoning that they give to that, to say, no, they're empowered to change the whole timetable. I think it's the one that opens them to criticism and it's the one that opens, the IEC to being accused of bias and which ultimately affect its credibility. But I don't think we are there, Bramike. I think the people, the opposition, especially the DA and especially its leader, Helen Zille, has been too harsh on the IEC. There has not been an instant where we think that the IEC is biased towards a particular party. I don't think we have reached that point. But I think this decision raises questions. And it's very unfortunate that such questions are raised just before such an important election. But I don't think we are there with the point where the credibility of the IEC now gets questioned, and now we need we start not trusting the IEC as citizens. I think we are not there, but I think that their decision opens the IEC to a lot of it opens a lot of suspicion and I think that's where we are. But we're not at that point where the credibility of the IEC is now in tatters.
Ibrahim, what is your reading? So should we care actually about the reputation of the IEC?
Absolutely, it's vital. I mean, the IEC used to rank in public perception surveys, and I'm not talking about the ones done by marketing and other companies. I'm talking about the credible ones done by the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation, or the Human Sciences Research Council, and so on, because their methodologies are fairly sound. But their surveys have always shown that along with the courts, the IEC enjoyed high levels of public trust and high levels of public confidence. I'm afraid the last Institute for Justice and Reconciliation barometer survey showing that the IEC's reputation in a short 5 years has plummeted. And so the public perception is not very good, and we should worry about it, not just because it was high, but because it is a central cog in administering and managing free and fair elections. More importantly, because it is the facilitator of the process by which we legitimate people to exercise power and authority on our behalf. So they at the heart of this thing, you know, they rank along and should rank along with the courts, but they don't anymore. Now, not all of it is of their own fault. I think the last little while has shown that some of the decisions they made have been fairly rash. I think some of it unconvincing, as Sibonga Konka says. But a lot of it has come about because of the unnecessary assault on the reputation of the IEC. And we must all be very careful and not give in to what the politicians say. It's not just the DA and Helen Zeller who's been rubbishing the IEC. She's been doing it of late. But remember the ANC, even its senior leaders in the last election told one of the commissioners, and I'm quoting verbatim here, "You are part of the enemy." Now, in a democracy, you don't have enemies. You have competitors. But they branded an independent institution who did nothing wrong at that stage, by the way, as part of the enemy. Other political parties blame the IEC because they don't have enough funding. They don't have access to broadcast airtime. But that's not the fault of the IEC. The funding formula, whether public and now private, and now with the Private Funding Act and disclosure requirements, that's regulation which is made by Parliament. That's a law made by Parliament. IEC has nothing to do with it. IEC also doesn't announce the election date. That has to be proclaimed by the minister and announced by the president. The funding, the access to broadcast airtime is determined by ICASA. All sorts of regulatory questions which are determined in Parliament. So they've consistently blamed the IEC for this. Then you get other parties who say, no, look at the IEC. They hire all these people and they unionized. Well, where else do you find 250,000 people to run an election who have absolutely no political inclination whatsoever? So all of these spurious allegations which opposition parties have made, including the ANC, by the way, not just the opposition, who spuriously always blame the IEC, is now coming back to haunt society. And you look across the continent at every instance of intractable conflict, the spark has always been emerging from some electoral contest in which the blame is focused on the election manager. Now, our IEC is appointed in a fairly robust and independent way. Our IEC is not necessarily made up of formal representatives from different political parties, as they might be on the rest of the continent. So there, the spark for conflict is much easier. You can blame and say, so-and-so commissioner, so-and-so comes from party X, Y, and Z, and therefore pushing that agenda. People are now saying that about our IEC. And I think we should try to protect the reputation of the IEC. Criticize them where relevant, where they made the mistakes, and they have made many. Criticize them when there are things that they get wrong, but don't unnecessarily criticize them as they have been. Lastly, we all need to get better at understanding the very robust and comprehensive architecture for the regulation of elections and the oversight of elections. And multi-party liaison committees, conflict management panels, the electoral court, party agents for that matter, signing off on electoral slips at the end of the process when the result is tabulated per voting station. Those are all safeguards built into the system. So we all need to get better, especially in the media, at understanding the processes and the procedures by which the IEC work and what the safeguards of the regulatory architecture and oversight mechanisms are.
No, I won't get, Ibrahim says we all have to get our act together. Now, let's ask about the other people, you know, if they can get their act together, the ANC. I mean, they've contested elections so many times. You'd expect that by now, their electoral administration would be running like a well-oiled machine. Do you think that they are capable of getting rid of the chaos, the administrative chaos, or is it too far gone?
They have another bite, Pramike, and it remains to be seen. So Jesse Duarte has given ANC structures until Saturday to actually fix the mess. And so there's going to be a lot of branch meetings and committee meetings to again try and elect the right people. It remains to be seen if they can do it, Pramike. I think maybe the reason why they failed to meet their deadlines was that they were dealing with a large number of such processes like branch meetings and committee meetings and then reports coming into the house. But now if they say they're giving 24 hours, now they are dealing with the smaller number, and I think they will have enough time to resolve whatever conflict was there, because now Jesus Duarte has given an instruction to regional secretaries and the provincial secretaries to be in charge of the process and make sure that it happens. And if anything goes wrong, then now she has people to blame, and the party has people to blame, and then there's someone who's going to take the flag. And depending on the outcome of these meetings and whether everyone agrees, I think they have enough time to get their act together. But it's the ANC. You never know what's going to happen. You might find people throwing chairs at each other in these meetings, and you end up not having any outcome. So it remains to be seen. Let's wait and see until Saturday.
Okay, gentlemen. Thank you very much. I think we'll stop it there. This is an unfolding running story, which we will continue to keep our eyes on.
Sports Radio.
Tielemans, who can hit them. Oh, spectacular goal by Youri Tielemans.
Official broadcaster of the English Premier League commentary. Go to sportsradio.co.za. Show support for your favourite team, match of the day, or any game you'd like to follow. Plus up to 2 hours of great sports audio a day. T's and C's apply.
Now for the big story of the week, the granting of medical parole to the convicted former president, Jacob Zuma, which has also led to predictable controversy. We're joined for that conversation now by a political analyst, Professor Chinyuko Maluleke from the University of Pretoria. With us still is Smangonke Shoba, who is the Sunday Times politics editor. What is likely to be the political impact of Jacob Zuma being granted parole, especially among his followers in KZN? How will they read it?
His followers in KZN are celebrating. The provincial secretary of KwaZulu-Natal has already said that this leaves a lot of weight that was on their shoulders, because had it not happened, they would have been asked difficult questions by some of their voters who love Zuma so much that they would want to question them about his incarceration when they go to campaign for votes. So it's very much welcomed in that part of the country. But Pramike, it has serious consequences for the state and the credibility of the state and whether we are all equal before the law and whether all processes are followed, especially following the revelation last night by the National Commissioner of Correctional Services, Mr. Arthur Fraser, who told the SABC that the parole board had actually decided against Rizzi Zuma on medical parole, and that it was the head of the center where Zuma was supposed to be incarcerated who actually recommended that he be released, and Arthur Fraser had to rescind that decision of the parole board, and he took responsibility for having released Zuma, saying that the law allows him to do that. And Pramike, you can think of so many, you can think of how many people are languishing in prison and are having terminal illness, and they are applying again and again. And not all of them have friends in high places like Jacob Zuma. So that's the political implication of it, is that it says that even though there's this commitment from President Cyril Ramaphosa to clean up the state, clean up his party, but such things still happen under him. And when he closed, he was delivering the closing address at the Lekgotla of his party, the African National Congress, he said that the party welcomes the release of President Zuma. And now you think, how much did he know of it? Did Fraser inform the president? Did Fraser inform the Minister of Justice? And were they all part of this decision that is now seemed to be very much controversial?
Professor Maluleke, do you read the situation in the same way?
Yeah, more or less I do. I think that Look, to begin with, we expected this almost from day one when President Zuma was incarcerated. People started speculating about when will he get his medical parole. Because at the back of everyone's mind, there was the Shabir Sheikh case. So we've been here before. This movie has been seen before. And so South Africans were correct to expect that it would proceed this way. Although the detail that has since emerged is somewhat different in that there was apparently no medical parole board, which on the basis of which former President Zuma has been released. He has been released rather on the strength of the recommendation of Fraser, who is in charge of prisons. And Fraser has the temerity even to say that it was his decision and his alone, and that in fact the board might not have agreed with him on this. So this is quite astounding, much more astounding than South Africans might have expected. But be that as it may, whatever the details are, I would expect that the Minister of Justice and the President, one way or the other, should have known about this before it happened. Whether they knew about it and agreed, or knew about it and didn't agree but had no power, is what I don't know. But I don't see how the Minister of Justice, Ronald Lamola, was completely in the dark as far as this is concerned. And my question is, what did he know? What did he do about it? What did the President know, and what did he do about it?
Just to backtrack a bit, the former president, Jacob Zuma, seems to be, I mean, he left office quite a while ago now, but he seems to remain a factor in our politics. Why is that? One would have expected that at his age, given the allegations that have been made against him at the State Capture Commission, the charges that are still awaiting him, that his reputation would have suffered, or that his influence at least would have waned. Why has he remained a viable political factor?
Well, former presidents have by definition political overdraft, which they can use way beyond their terms of office, just by virtue of being former presidents. And you could say the same of President Mbeki. He's not completely without influence, even though he's no longer president of the country for some time now. So that's the easy answer. But the more complicated answer is that Jacob Zuma has been probably one of the most powerful ANC leaders since Nelson Mandela. His influence has been way more than the ordinary and the usual. And for that reason, he continues to loom large. I mean, I don't know if you had that leaked recording of the top six of the ANC meeting with him. Whether it was an authentic recording or not, we don't know. But the voices sounded familiar. You will realize just how powerful he continues to be. He was basically talking down at them. And each one of them was almost apologetic in their responses to him. So he has been a very, very a colossal figure in ANC politics in recent years. And it seems to me that he continues to be that, especially in KZN.
Sibongakonke, when you look at the situation now, post the granting of parole of this controversial decision, would you say that the country is better off with him serving time inside or outside prison?
Pramit, I was shocked that he even went to prison. I think that's an important point. I was shocked that he even went to prison. I expected him to use his friends in high places to keep on avoiding the situation, and it caught up with him to a point where he couldn't run anymore. But I think we've achieved what the Constitutional Court wanted to achieve. I think it has been achieved to show and send out a message that no one is above the law. I think it was important for that message to be sent out, And I think it was important that he went to prison or got whatever sentence that was meted to him and served it. The fact that he is out now, it's good for the country because there's going to be that level of stability, if I may use that word, and that they adopt the prospect of us having diehard supporters of President Zuma running amok and disrupting peace in the country is now limited. That is the positive we can get out of it. And what we needed to achieve as a country to send that message out, even if he had slept a day in that prison, the message had already gone out that we are all equal before the law. Because Bramaik, as part of why Zuma remains so influential in our politics, as the prof was saying, is also because he had spread enough patronage to so many people. And most of those people, Bramaik, the reason why they were fighting so much for him is not because they love him so much, but it's because they are implicated in whatever he was doing. And those are the people who wanted him not to go to prison so that there is a precedent that is set that, if you can do so much wrong and you can't go to prison. And they were going to use that, to protect themselves and to continue doing whatever they are doing. And for Zuma to go to prison, it sent out a very good message to say that no one is above the law. And if you are on the wrong side of the law, you get punished.
And yet, Prof. Maluleke, just to close off, this would not mark, this would not be the final word in terms of what happens with Jacob Zuma, because he's got quite a number of charges that he's facing still in relation to the arms deal. Might we not face the same problem as a consequence of that forthcoming trial if it does go ahead?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so the trial continues. If he is found guilty and is sentenced, it depends on the nature of the sentence. He might still have to go to jail. But the fact that we have sent him to jail once obviously means that we can send him to jail again if necessary. I am not quite happy with the situation where we even want to think that, it is a security risk to imprison anyone who has done wrong, should the courts find that that person has done wrong. I don't think we should even go there and worry about it being a security risk. I think that it's important that the law takes its course right now, just like it did in the previous case, and that the law is followed to the letter. And I hope that his parole release is also absolutely lawful. And it is possible that it is absolutely lawful. But should it not be lawful, my fear is that someone somewhere may challenge it, and sooner or later we will know the truth. So the important thing is that the law is upheld all the time. And if prison is the way to go, it should go. And if parole is possible, either on the basis of time done or on the basis of medical reasons, for which we don't really need to know the details, so be it. But I don't think we should sit here and worry and speculate as to how safe shall we be if he goes back to prison. I mean, the question is, why should he not go to prison if he is sentenced to go back to prison?
Okay. Gentlemen, that's all we have time for on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly for this week. And I'd like to thank you very much for joining us for our conversation. Our guests, electoral analyst Ibrahim Fakir, Simon Gonkeshova, who's the Sunday Times Politics editor, as well, of course, as Professor Dinuko Maluleke, who is a political analyst from the University of Pretoria. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. And by the way, you can find a podcast of this conversation on iono.fm, on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer to source your podcasts. Until next time, we still say stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places.